Love is a very relative term. And what we mean when we say love and what we hear when we hear that someone loves us may not always be the same thing. We're raised in different environments where love is selfish or love is unselfish. We're raised in situations and circumstances where someone might say, I love you, if they feel a sense of possessive need or if they feel a joy and a happiness in being in the presence. But human love is something that each one of us has developed through our life. And every one of us have developed that in a different way. Some of us were raised in homes with very loving parents. Some of us were raised in homes with very selfish parents. Love means something different in those two different circumstances. And so if we don't know the scriptures, then this human love is all we know, whatever it might be, whatever we were raised with, whatever the sense of enjoyment or the sense of need or the sense of dependence or whatever we mean when we say, I love you. And unfortunately, that's what we hear when God says, I love you, because you can't really rise above that. It's like most vocabulary words. We can only understand them to the degree that we've been trained or discussed it. We've talked about the word needle before. If you are a seamstress, needle means something different than if you knit. And needle means something entirely different if you work for a doctor and you give shots, and something entirely different if you are involved with suturing. And so when I say needle, you are going to be thinking, and everybody might have a different thing in their mind. Because that's what vocabulary does. And the more we understand about a word, and this is the problem sometimes when we're reading the Bible, we're reading what we hear, but we're not reading what God is actually saying. And that's one of the things that is very important about this subject, because there are two words in the Bible for love which the English cannot give to us, and therefore often as we read the term, we really do not fully understand. And of course, without understanding, how are we going to rise to the level? And so we must take the time to understand how exactly this particular term is used, and try to rise above what we learned from our own personal experience. Because as I said a moment ago, love is a very relative term in the human realm. And we find that out as we live our lives. So when I say I love my wife or my children or my job, when I say I love my car or I love ice cream, when I say I love chocolate cookies, or I love to study, or I love to eat, or I love to read, what am I saying? Well, I think we understand that love kind of moves from subject to subject and maybe modified a little different. Maybe I don't love my wife the same way I love a vacation. Maybe I don't love to read the same way I love my children. But we have a word that is elastic enough. And as we read these things, most of us can make the adjustments and understand that one is pleasure, one is enjoyment, one is a sense of dependence, one is a sense of giving. We love our children differently than we love our wives because the relationship's different and the needs are different. And when I say I love my children, I have a very different feeling than when I say I love my wife. And when I say I love my job, it's something very, very different. And so in the New Testament, the word for love in the Greek language comes into our language with the word philosophy or friend or terms that describe philanthropy. And they use this particular word because this is the word for human love. And it's defined as friendly, to be friendly to one, a friend, one who finds his pleasure in a thing. Now, that's not a very deep love. That wouldn't be a love that we might want to apply when we're talking about our spouse or our family relationships. Maybe it's much more than a friendliness. In another context, or when we look at the verb, to love, to be friendly, to delight in, to long for, to love to do with pleasure. And then it's also used for the word kiss. Now, most of us, as we read those definitions, we can find that the love that we have will fit into it. As we go back over that list, some of the things we take pleasure in, some of the things we love to do, some of the things we delight in, some of the things we long for, some of the things we find pleasure within. And so, and again, this is human love. But it's human love based on whatever colored glasses we view our life from, based on our experiences, based on our knowledge. And again, as I said, there are so many ways to be raised. So many circumstances that we can go through. So many things that can occur. Betrayals that modify. When somebody says, I love you, and then they betray. When we go through a situation where someone's anger overwhelms their love, and suddenly we find that the person who says, I love you, is now hurting us. And so some of us have learned to see love in a very different way. And each one of us has to recognize that, because when we come to the Bible, we read a term, we have to understand that we are reading the same term, but we're not all coming away with the same word. We're not coming away with the same understanding. And that's why it's hard for some people to grow. Because when I'm hearing a word that means something completely different from what I understand it, then I'm not going to be able to rise above that until I understand the way that it's actually being used. And so, as I said, the yellow here, I think, are the main concepts of human love as they're defined in the scriptures. And essentially it has to do with pleasure, delight, longing for, and these are concepts that have to be in human love. If I don't have these feelings, I can't say I love you. If I have no pleasure in your company, I don't consider you a friend. I don't delight in or long to be in your presence. I don't love to do anything with you. There's no pleasure in the relationship. And then somebody says, do you love me? Well, how am I going to answer that? Well, if I'm honest, I'm going to say, no, I don't love you. Not in that sense. So when we talk about phileo love or philos love, and of course most of you who have been in these studies before understand I'm going toward the agape love, which is a different word entirely. But this is human love in all its glory and in all its power. And brethren, it's one of the most wonderful things that we possess, the ability to tie ourselves to another human being and to feel pleasure and delight. To long for and to enjoy is something that people sing about, people talk about, everyone wants to feel it, everyone wants the enjoyment of it, and it is a very pleasurable activity. However, there is a limitation there that I want to develop as the lesson continues. And so, before we become a Christian, and especially if we haven't been influenced by the Scripture, then that's all we can mean, and that's all we can hear. When I say I love you, that's what you're hearing. You're hearing what you understand to be love. And I'm saying what I understand to be love, and of course sometimes they're entirely different. But it's all we can hear, it's all we can understand. But you know, when it says God so loved the world, that's a different word. And God doesn't mean what we think he means, because that word has an entirely different meaning. And so that's kind of where we're headed, but we want to talk a little bit more about something. It's not evil. It's just a fundamental part of our lives, and God understands that. God understands that when we come, say, to 1 Corinthians 13, and we read about the agape love or the divine love, we find that our love is just a dim reflection, a small portion of what it was. Now remember, if we go back to the Garden of Eden and we think about being created in the image and likeness of God and feeling exactly the way God feels, for a time, Adam and Eve were mirror images of God. They thought the way he thought, they felt the way he felt, they talked the way he talked, they lived the way he lived. It wasn't until sin came that selfishness and other emotions came into play, which quickly removed the loving environment and change it into something entirely different. So when we talk about this human love, And again, I don't want to belabor the point, but I just want to make it. I want to make sure we all understand that before we become a Christian, we use the word love, we don't really understand agape yet. We don't really understand divine love. We haven't been introduced to it, and maybe our folks didn't show it to us. Maybe our friends didn't show it to us. Maybe the people, the girlfriends or the boyfriends that we had going through our early years, maybe they had no clue what it was. And so we have a very skewed view, and we have to recognize that and be prepared to grow beyond it. So if we don't feel these emotions, though, then again, as I said earlier, we don't feel entirely honest. Do you love me? Sometimes my wife asks me that. And sometimes I say, ask me later, because at that particular moment, the emotions are not there. And I'm not going to lie to her. Maybe I'm irritated, or maybe I'm frustrated, or maybe I haven't had a good night's sleep. And you say, do you love me? Well, yeah, I loved you yesterday, and I'll love you tomorrow. But right now, it's a struggle. Because we have to be honest, right? We do. Now, if she says I love you and I lie to her, is that going to make her happy? Isn't it better for me to tell her the truth, even though maybe the truth might hurt? I better stop here. She's laughing now, but she might be laughing later. But that's where we start. Okay, that's where we start. And we've all, if we haven't been courageous enough to ask the question, we've all wondered it, haven't we? Does my husband still love me? Does my wife still love me? Do my parents love me? Do my children love me? These are fundamental questions, because they create self-esteem. They create a sense of value and purpose. In other words, these are the things that are the cement upon which all human relationships are based on. And you can't build a life on things. You have to build it on people. And so that's why these things are so important. Now, Jesus had two choices when he came. I see I got these upside down, so we'll just put them both up there. Jesus had two choices. He could take the human love, the phileo, the philos love that existed in the time that he was born, and he could broaden them out to take in everything he had come to teach man about the love of God and about the mercy and compassion of God and about what the gospel was going to be able to produce in man. Or he could help man see the limitations of this love and use a different word to describe the divine love that man had lost through the selfishness of sin. Now, brethren, that's, in all honesty, that's why we all have a different view of love, is because of sin. Because sin has intervened and changed someone's love into far less than it could be, whether impatience or irritation or jealousy or envy or whatever emotions kick in a husband-wife relationship or in a parent-child relationship, will modify forever the way the individuals involved in that relationship are going to see love. And so if we had a harsh father, if we had a mother, my father told me about his father. He was a very hard man, brutal man. And his mother was an alcoholic. I always wondered why my dad had such a struggle being the kind of father that I wanted him to be. And when I found out all of that, it certainly changed my view of he's not a very good person to he was a victim of his own raising. He never became a Christian till late in life. I think he was in his late 70s, early 80s. And so the entire time that I knew my dad, he was not, and he could not give me what I needed. And so when I came to the gospel, I did not have a very good view of love. And I did not understand it. To me, it was a very selfish pleasure thing. And if that selfish pleasure wasn't there, then I could lash out. It was a very difficult time. And some of us have that, some of us don't. And that's why I say each one of us comes to this from a very different perspective. But Jesus decided that instead of taking this word and trying to renovate it and trying to help people see all of the things that I've been trying to develop in the course of this lesson regarding our own love, he just said, nope, we're going to create a brand new word. We're going to use a brand new word. Now, it was used before, but what we're going to see in the definition is that he took it and he changed it. He changed it into something entirely different. And so he chose the second option. Now, here's one of the Greek lexicons, and I just want to kind of develop this because I think it's an important thought. He says this is a purely, and he uses abbreviations, but I'll fill them out, a purely biblical and ecclesiastical word. In signification, it follows the verb agapao. Now, biblical means it's only in the Bible. Ecclesiastical means it's only in those writings that were written by the church fathers and the early church fathers and have passed down. This word, prior to Jesus' coming, was not a word that the human philosophers like Plato and Aristotle and others who lived before Christ, this was not one of those words that they took a lot of time with and they thought was an important term. Matter of fact, to them, this was almost a self or a servant's attitude. They didn't really see this as something that would be the starting point to build a religion on. But Jesus did. Jesus saw this unselfish care and concern, this servant's attitude, as the very heart of divine love. And so he took the word that they didn't want to use and they didn't think had any real value, and he molded it into the word that he wanted. Here's what Vine says. Agapao and agape present the characteristic word of Christianity. And since the Spirit of Revelation has used it to express ideas previously unknown, inquiry into its use, whether in Greek literature or in the Septuagint, throws but little light upon its distinctive meaning in the New Testament. Now, the Septuagint, of course, is the Old Testament that was translated into Greek, and when the translators found certain Greek words, certain Hebrew words, they would use agape or agapao. But as he said, it doesn't throw much light because, as Jesus said in John 13, I'm going to give you a brand new commandment, never given before, couldn't be understood before because there was never a point of reference before. You love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no man than this, to lay down his life for his friends. So, brethren, we have got to learn or try to grapple with the fact that when we're reading words in the Bible, if we're reading them from our perspective, but Jesus is speaking them from God's perspective, we're not going to grow. We can't grow because we don't really understand what we're reading. Remember Philip asking the Ethiopian eunuch, do you understand what you're reading? How can I unless someone could guide me? And so that's what Jesus came to do. He came to guide us from this selfish, perverted, and often damaged human love that had been used for centuries, millennium, as the selfish means to use other people for our own ends. And sometimes that's all somebody means when they say, I love you, is I find in you something that I can use. And as long as you are useful, I will love you. When you stop feeling useful for me, I will discard you. Look at the divorce rates today and tell me that isn't so. Tell me that human love today, with a divorce rate just almost astronomical, and yet these two people, before they were married, proclaimed their everlasting love for one another. Well, what happened? Well, they didn't know what they were saying. They didn't understand what they meant. So as you look at the definitions of these terms, what we see is that this is a term that expresses ideas previously unknown. So when I read it, I've got to stop and say, I don't really understand this word. An inquiry into the poets of the Greek era, or the people today in our culture, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, if they aren't coming from a biblical perspective, they'll never get it. And we can't add it to our faith. Some people see where we're headed, of course. We're in the middle of 2 Peter chapter 1. Add to your faith virtue, to your virtue knowledge, to your knowledge self-control, to your self-control perseverance, to your perseverance godliness, to your godliness brotherly kindness, and to your brotherly kindness love. When many people who read that word, they think human love. It's all they can think. They don't have any other point of reference. And that's why sermons like this are so important. Now again, I'm bringing to our remembrance, bringing it from the back of the mind into the front of the mind. Most of us are at least aware of these things. But we have to appreciate that when God says, I love you, it doesn't mean whatever it is that we were raised with. It doesn't mean whatever we think it might mean. It only means exactly what he means it to be. Because he's the standard. He's the divine standard upon which all of us have to build. And unless we take the time to recognize there is so much selfishness in my love, so much, you know, you got this pure gold and then you find a nugget and it's just all mixed in with quartz and everything else. And what do you have to do? Well, you break it. And then you have to heat it and you have to melt out the gold, and there's things you have to do to get pure gold. Well, that's how we have to recognize we have a lot of quartz in our gold, in the sense of we have a lot of impurities. There's selfishness. There is misunderstandings. There are other emotions that intervene and lead us to do things that to people we say we love that are not at all what we should be doing. So at any rate, Jesus chose the second option here. He found a word purely biblical, purely spiritual, purely involved with the church to express ideas previously unknown. And the reason they're unknown is because they got lost. Adam and Eve had them, but we call it the fall. And in the fall, Adam and Eve marred their image. And we got whatever parents we got whatever friends we got, whatever girlfriends or boyfriends we got, whatever human relationships we got, and it just depended on who they were. Some of us got tremendous opportunities to enjoy the highest of what human love can give, and some of us were cheated and didn't get very much of it at all. Some of us are very skewed. Some of us are a little bit apathetic and calloused, and we don't really believe in love. You know, here's people, I don't believe in love. I don't believe that people have love. I think it's just a selfish emotion where people get what they can get, but God gives what he can give. God gives what he can give. So that's the difference. So when we talk about this love, we're talking about a purely biblical word that expresses ideas previously unknown. So just forget it. If you think to yourself, well, I'm going to be able to draw from how my mother and father treated me to understand this love. No, you won't. Well, I'm going to be able to draw from all the good things that all the people gave me throughout my life, and I'll be able to draw from that. No, you won't. You won't be able to do that, because although there are some overlaps, until you see what the overlaps are in the scriptures, you won't know which way to go about it. Because when we talk about these kinds or this kind of love, and then we compare it to this kind of love, we see some similarities. But if it's a purely biblical word, then why can't we draw from, and if it's a word that's commonly used, why didn't Jesus just use that word? No, he chose another word. And so we call the first natural affection. We've known it from our youth, and it doesn't really take any effort because we just do what comes natural. Now, as I say, not always a very pure love. It's not always a very kind love. It's not always a very unselfish love because it's based on how we were raised and what we've had to deal with other people and how we've been treated in our life. But the natural affection of divine love, we learn from God. Now, God doesn't mistreat people. Now, some people think that God is not a God of love and mercy, but you know something? John, in 1 John, several times, he says, God is love. Not love is God, but God is love. And so, whatever love means, it is coming from the eternal Creator who is properly using emotions and trying to become the template that we can come back to and love our wives, and love our children, and love one another, and love God, and love Jesus, not with this dim reflection of love that we were raised to understand. but with the power of love that we find in the Scriptures. So, human love is prone to selfishness. Human love is moved by emotion. But divine love is completely unselfish and is moved by Scripture. In other words, when I'm about to do what comes natural, but the Scripture directs me in another direction, I'm going to manifest one of two loves. Either the love I was raised with and the love that is not really love at all. We call it that. But it's not what love is supposed to be, what love is supposed to do. And so there are some similarities, though, as you can see. There is affection, there is goodwill, and there is love in divine love. But there's a self-limiting circumstance here that we need to wrestle with. And that is, true love is more interested in the person that is loved than in the feelings of the one who loves. Now, let that sink in for a minute. True love is more interested in the needs, desires, and emotions of the person who is loved than they are in what responses they get from the person. Now, that's how it would have to be, because how could God love sinful man? What is there about sinful man? What pleasure could God take in loving loving completely selfish, corrupt people who have done things deserving of being banished forever? How could God love those kinds of people? Well, with human love, he couldn't. But with divine love, the love that cares more about our need. Now, we have people that have that kind of love. You remember Paul in Romans chapter 5 saying, scarcely for a righteous man someone would die, perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. We read about that in the paper a couple times a year, maybe more, where somebody rushes in, risks their own life and dies trying to save someone else. Someone's being pulled out to sea, they go in to save them. Now, a lot of people wouldn't do that. A lot of people's concept of love would not lead them to lift a finger to help someone else in trouble. They got themselves into trouble. They get themselves out of trouble. I'm in it for me. Now, there's a love like that. But there's also a love. Human love can reach a level where I'm going to sacrifice myself for you. If your car's on fire, I'm going to rush up. I'm going to break the window, and I'm going to try to get you out. And if I die trying, well, that's okay. Because your need was greater than my life. Now, there's people out there that feel like that. Maybe you feel like that. But there's a lot of people out there that, you know, we read about this too, where somebody's pleading for help and the passerbys are just passing by until the person is dead and nobody cares. Of course, that makes many of us sick. But some of us understand it completely. As I say, it's all depending on how we were raised and how we are wired, because these are natural things that come along. But God wants more. So there needs to be a merging. Let's go to 1 John chapter 4. I don't usually go this long without quoting a lot of scriptures, but if we're going to talk about human love, that's where we have to go. We have to go outside of the scriptures. But in 1 John chapter 4 now, in verse 7, and we'll spend the rest of the sermon talking more about what God expects us. It says, beloved, let us love one another. Now, don't read human love here. Don't read phileo or philos here. It's not there. Matter of fact, I don't think philos and phileo is even used in the book of 1 John. This is the divine love that is based on sacrificing for others and seeing other people's needs as the motivation for what we do. Now, what we get out of it? We don't calculate what's in it for me. And if it's nothing in it for me, I don't get any pleasure, I don't get any enjoyment, I don't get any benefit, forget it. I'm not going to do that. That's not this love. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. Now, do you see how this fits in so well with everything we've introduced up to this point? We can't know God until we understand His love. And we will never understand His love until we set aside what we call love and go to the back to the drawing board and say, I've really got to learn what this is, because unless I have, I don't understand it yet. Beloved, let us love one another. For love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. Now, if I read human love in here, I'm not going to understand the verse. If I read human love, then I've already got all this, and I don't, who does not love? Everybody loves. No, not like this. Verse 9, in this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent His only Son into the world. Now, He leaves silent, but the fact is, God sent His only begotten Son into the world to die for us and to sacrifice for us. From what we read in Philippians chapter 2, when He emptied Himself and came to this earth to become a servant, the suffering started far before the garden. Matter of fact, Isaiah says He was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So even though it's not verbalized, the fact is, when it says, in this the love of God was manifested toward us, that God sent His only begotten Son into the world that we might live through Him, that's the fundamental definition of divine love. And again, it's very different from what most of us think when we think of love. We don't think of love as a sacrifice. We think of love as a pleasure. We think of love as a need, as a delight, as an enjoyment, something that pleases us. Well, that's not this love. Verse 10, in this is love. Not that we love God because we could not, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God loved us like this, we also ought to love one another. I think this is where the disconnect comes. We don't understand this word love. And so when we read this verse, we can't really see it. It's cloudy to us. We don't really grapple with. Now, before this series of lessons is over, I hope that we can read this verse and see our own limitations and our own weaknesses and our own problems and pick ourselves up out of it and change ourselves into what we are actually supposed to be. We drop down to verse 19 now. We love Him because He first loved us. Now, I can fully understand that when I understand everything we've just read, that this is a purely biblical word that was never understood before, because it can only mean what God says it means, and that's why we can't love Him unless He first loves us. Because the love we have is far different from the love He has, and we have to imitate our love after His love. Verse 20, if someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this command we have from Him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. Now, this isn't talking about brother in the sense of Christians. This is talking about brother in the sense of you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Agape love, brotherly kindness, as we talked about the last couple of weeks, is based entirely upon our relationship in the church. But this love is based entirely upon what God felt for the world, and now we need to feel for the world. We talked about this morning in our lesson when we talked about the fact that before God's love entered our life, we were foolish and disobedient and ungodly and unlovable. Now, I recognize, and you recognize, that there's a lot of people in this world that are unlovable. There's no pleasure at all in having a relationship with them. There's nothing to be gained. It's all going to be giving and giving and giving because they don't have anything to give. This is the commandment we have from Him, that he who loves God must love his brother. If I don't love that man, then what John is saying here is that my love has not reached the level it needs to be yet. And these passages like this are very humbling, because they show us how far we have to go. They show us how immature we still are, and how chained we still are to our upbringing and to our natural affection, and we haven't been able to grow beyond it. So, this love can overlap, but it rises from an entirely different set of circumstances. Human love comes because we have some stake in the outcome. I'm going to get something from it. That's what gives me pleasure. If I love my work, it's because I get something from my work. If I love my wife, it's because I get something from my wife. If I don't love my wife, it's because I don't get anything. I don't have any pleasure anymore. I don't have any enjoyment anymore. Don't have any need anymore. And when that comes, I smack myself on the head and I go back to these verses and I change things around so it comes back. Makes us feel good. Gives us delight. It's a wonderful emotion to enrich marriage and family and work. But it's selfish. And it's based entirely upon what it brings and what it brings to me. And that's why many Christians will not make serious sacrifices. They've just never been trained. Their love can't go beyond this. It just can't. And that's why we have to grow, and that's why we have to develop. So Jesus revealed a higher motivation. Unselfish concern for the needs of others, in which we have no stake or benefit. Now, when you've done it long enough, this is actually more pleasurable and more enjoyable and more fulfilling and more comforting than human love. Because as we become more and more like God, we gain a peace and a serenity and relationships with people that aren't based on the ups and downs of emotions. They're based on the needs. When they're based on other people's needs, that's fixed. And my moods, my attitudes, they don't matter. Your needs don't change because of my moods or attitudes. Now, under human love, they do. If I'm in a bad mood, forget it. You're not going to get anything from me. If I wake up on the wrong side of the bed and my wife happens to say something that I don't like, my love is not going to be very nice. And we've all been there. Now, we know that's not love. But shouldn't love have stopped that? If we really loved, well, this love will, but that love will not. And so, when they're properly merged, this is God's definition of love. Now again, this is agape love, this is not human love, but as I said, they're supposed to come together. At some point in our life, they're one and the same. And the emotions we get from human love and the emotions we get from divine love merge into one, and sometimes we're drawing from this, and that's why Paul would say, I would gladly spend and be spent for your soul. In other words, his human love, the pleasure, the need, the enjoyment, the satisfaction, the delight, has merged with God's command to sacrifice and serve. And so he got his pleasure and his delight from sacrificing and serving. And when we reach that point, then we become long-suffering. Love suffers long. You can't provoke. Now we'll look at that a little bit later, because he's going to mention this again in verse 5. But when you have a long-suffering love, you're not going to get angry at somebody's statements. You're not going to get frustrated or irritated, because you're in it for them. And your desires and your needs are not based on what you get out of it. It's based on what you can give. Now that's something that's fixed. As long as it's what I can give and not what I have to get back, I don't have any control over what I get back. But I have total control over what I give. Now, the person I love oftentimes is unworthy of that. But think about God. Everybody he loves is unworthy of it. And yet, he gives it. We love because he first loved us. So love suffers long and is kind. When I'm impatient, when I'm not kind, then I'm under what I might call love, but it's not love. That's not love. And it won't cement a relationship. And it won't bring pleasure to the person who is loved. Love does not envy. There's nothing that good that can happen to someone that would cause another person to feel anger or frustration or uncomfortable or lose their pleasure because you got something I didn't or because you have something I don't have. Love can't do that. Love is so interested in the needs of another. You remember in the previous chapter, he talked about the body, and he said that the body has the same concern for each part. And when one member suffers, all the parts of the body suffer. And when one member is honored, all the parts of the body. So my finger doesn't envy my thumb, and my eye doesn't envy my ears, because we all work together. So love doesn't envy. And it doesn't parade itself or puffed up. There's no pride. There's nothing in it for me. There's no needs that I have that must be met. Verse 5, doesn't behave rudely. Whenever I act rudely to someone else, I am not manifesting divine love. Call it what you will. It's not love. Now, it's how we were raised. Maybe how our parents treated us. Maybe how our friends treated us. Maybe how our spouse treats us. Maybe that's all we know. Being rude. When divine love enters our heart, this will go away. If it's still there, then you know you have ways to go. And what you're calling love is not love at all. It's not selfish. Divine love is not selfish. Doesn't look for what it can get, looks for what it can give. Now think of how that would ennoble a marriage. Think of how that would ennoble a parent-child relationship. Think about how that would ennoble the church. If we just could get all the selfishness out. It's not provoked. Thinks no evil. Doesn't rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things. We just can't push it too far. Believes all things. It puts its trust. It hopes all things, hoping for the best, and endures all things. And this love never fails. So that's what I wanted to introduce this evening. I wanted to help us understand, and I say us, and I mean us, because, you know, 3 weeks from now, when I get away from this lesson, it just all goes back to the back of the mind. And my wife's expecting such great things after I preach these sermons, and then finds out this guy, he can preach it, but he doesn't always live it as well as he can preach it, which we all struggle with. We can see it, we can't always do it. So each one of us here has to look at it like this. When our love is not doing these things, then we're not allowing agape love to lead and modify and make noble our human love. And that's shame on us. That's a sign that we have not grown and developed as we should. So all I'm trying to do tonight is put a mirror up in front of us so we can see ourselves. We can see ourselves clearly. We can see how much of a Christian am I really? How much love do I really have? Now, some of us, again, we were just blessed with a good upbringing. And so people say, wow, how much love, look at how much love they have. But maybe they haven't changed at all. It's just the way they were raised. And the love of Christ and the love of God has still not entered their heart, because it can't go far enough. And this is a struggle. We're going to struggle with it. I suspect we'll struggle with it for the rest of our lives, because as Paul says, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. When you can do that, everything else is going to be falling into place. And so, as we now open up our songbooks, we're going to sing number 212. We're going to sing about some of the wonderful things that God has done and some of the terrible things that we have done, and maybe there's some changes we need to make in our life. Actually, I guess this song is just talking about all the wonderful things that are going to come. So I should have looked at the song first. If your heart is concerned at this moment, if you feel like you need to make some changes, then my counsel would be that you start praying. Write this down. Go home. Again, put it on your refrigerator. Put it on your mirror. Don't forget it. It'll be in the back of your mind by Tuesday or Wednesday. Unless you do something about it right now. So make a plan. Make decision, start praying about it, start trying to incorporate it into your life. If you've done things that are in violation of this, you need to repent. You need to ask God for forgiveness. If you've mistreated your family, your friends, your co-workers, your brethren, if you haven't manifested this love, maybe there's somebody you need to go and talk to and say, you know, I'm really sorry. I'm going to do that with my wife tonight, I think. Maybe you need to, too. But as we sing this song, if there's anybody in the audience who needs to publicly confess sin, or maybe this evening you'd like to be baptized into Christ and wash away your sins, if there's anything we can do, would you please make it known while we together stand and sing?